and the regular Sunday afternoon address of Father Charles E. Coughlin from Royal Oak, Michigan.
Greetings, ladies and gentlemen, from Father Coughlin, the pastor of the Shrine of Little Flower at Royal Oak, Michigan. As you know, these broadcasts are made possible and are paid for at full commercial rates because of the magnificent support which you have extended to Father Coughlin directly and because of your support of Social Justice Magazine. May I tell you something about the financial setup of this publication? Social Justice Publication is a corporation, a profit corporation. However, in the past and in the future, just as long as Social Justice is printed, every penny of profit derived from its being published goes entirely and without any reservation to Father Coughlin to enable him to bring this weekly message to you. And something else of interest. Father Coughlin and the directors of Social Justice Publishing Corporation realized that this publication must expand. And by expand, I mean that it must enlarge its editorial staff. It must perfect its presentation. It must establish more offices. Within the month, all this will be done. More editors, specialists in politics, in economics, in foreign affairs, and more reporters are being engaged at the moment. And editorial offices are being organized in New York City and Washington. Ladies and gentlemen, you and your subscriptions have made this possible. Thank you. Thank you 1,000 times. And in this struggle to preserve Christianity and Americanism, the procedure will not become easier. We must support Father Coughlin and protect him as he carries on this contest. Protect him legally, financially, and in every other manner. But enough of this. We recognize that the fidelity which has characterized you over the years will not wane. Today, your spokesman, our spokesman for whom we work and into whose hands we gladly give all our profits, this spokesman will address you on the subject of the Popular Front. Copies of this address are available to every person in this audience if you will simply address your request to Father Coughlin at Royal Oak, Michigan. And now, ladies and gentlemen, Father Coughlin.
My friends, ladies and gentlemen, during the course of a Dies Committee investigation of un-American activities, there appeared before the committee Dr. Matthews, an eminent scholar, and formerly associated with many of the radical and subversive movements in the United States. Dr. Matthews presented to the Dies Committee, under oath, a testimony which was substantiated by documents. A testimony which is authentic, frank, shocking, and uncontradictory. A testimony which lays bare the Popular Front of Bolshevism in the United States. Because so many questions have come to my desk asking for information on the Bolshevik Popular Front now operating in our midst, I thought it prudent to avoid making any statement as of my own and to submit to this audience the uncontradicted word of Dr. Matthews, which I copy verbatim from the official documents of the United States government. In this brief space of time, it is impossible to include all the testimony this especially well-informed scholar contributed to the investigating committee. Necessarily, therefore, I will content myself with quoting excerpts. My friends, you have heard of the United Front, of the Popular Front. Perhaps you did not hear that Lenin, the high priest of Bolshevism, once maintained that his principles would succeed not through the direct agency of the Communist Party, but rather through the agency of other organizations dominated by Bolsheviks. Now, this is precisely what is taking place in America at the moment. Organize! 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 We must build communism with non-communistic hands. These were the words of Lenin. These words outline the policy adopted for communist progress. It is the boring from within tactic. It is the Trojan horse strategy. Yes, organize, organize, organize. We must build communism with non-communistic hands. How well Lenin and his disciples have succeeded will be exemplified in the words of Dr. Matthews, who admittedly was one of the organizers, one of the borers from within, one of the soldiers of destruction hidden within the stomach of the Trojan horse. Dr. Matthews said, quotation, "The Communist Party relies for its extensive influence in public affairs on the tactic which is known as the United Front. It is by the means of this device that the party's influence reaches far beyond its immediate enrolled membership. Nothing is more essential to a thorough understanding of communist methods and purposes than a detailed knowledge of the United Front. I propose," continues Dr. Matthews, "I propose to submit to this congressional committee some of my own intimate and extensive knowledge of the United Front. For a period covering the years 1932 to 1935, it is doubtful whether any other person in this country was associated more prominently than I with the Communist Party's so-called Innocent Club. That the Bolsheviks have not neglected the youth of the nation is evident from the many organizations established for their perversion. Passing over the Student Congress Against War, the National Student League, the American Student Union, I shall quote Dr. Matthews first on the American Youth Congress in which he was interested, one of the arms of the Popular Front. As you know, ladies and gentlemen, this organization, the American Youth Congress, has been in existence for 5 years. It has passed many resolutions against fascism and Nazism. At its recent national convention, and specifically at the plenary session of all the delegates to the Congress, held Monday morning, July 3rd, a resolution condemning communism was submitted by William T. Ball. This resolution was rejected by the Youth Congress, which eventually went on record as refusing to pass any clear-cut condemnation of communism. Now, Dr. Matthews says of this well-advertised organization, quotation, "Closely associated with the American Student Union and deriving much of its impetus and direction from it, is the American Youth Congress. According to the official version of its history, the idea and plan for an American Youth Congress were conceived 4 years ago by one Viola Illmann. who was alleged to have brought back fascist sympathies from a trip to Europe. In one of its pamphlets entitled Youngville, USA, the American Youth Congress has the following to say about Miss Ilma. She invited representatives from national youth organizations, reaching all the way from the Boy Scouts to the Young Communist League. Her arrangements were remarkably efficient and all-inclusive. And that was her mistake. The fact is that because Miss Ilma was so all-inclusive in her invitation, the Young Communist League, in concert with left-wing socialists, captured her organization in its infancy and threw her out. This is made clear in Wolf Michael's report of the Sixth World Congress of the Young Communist International. Writing of this capture, Wolf Michael says, quotation, thanks to the joint participation and work of the young American comrades with the socialists and other non-fascist youth at the Youth Congress, our Young Communist League of the United States helped to bring about a unity of several non-fascist organizations with a membership of over a million. Addressing himself to the members of the Young Communist International gathered in Moscow, Wolf Michael said further, this is an example of how to influence the masses of youth. Dr. Matthews continues. He says, the American Youth Congress is an excellent example of the methods and purposes of the Communist Party's United Front. Among the organizations which have been persuaded to endorse the Youth Congress and to participate in its communist-guided work, we find numerous groups of Christian young people, such as the National Council of Methodist Youth and the Christian Youth Conference of North America. Among the individuals sponsoring the Youth Congress as members of its so-called National Advisory Committee, we find, in addition to the usual left-wingers, who appear frequently on United Front committees, the names of Ralph S. Cushman, Bishop of the Methodist Episcopal Church, Hal G. Hoffman, Governor of New Jersey, Henry Noble McCracken, President of Vassar College. Ostensibly, these organizations and individuals are associated with a youth organization which is dedicated to peace as one of its major goals. But actually they are being made the innocent dupe of a carefully contrived communist maneuver. By peace, as the communists understand it and work for it, is meant a breathing spell during which the world revolution of the proletariat may be prepared. Wolf Michael, in his report, continues Dr. Matthews, from which I have already quoted, declares that the American Youth Congress fights for peace because, among other things, it means that the world proletariat is given still more time to rally its forces for the final overthrow of capitalism. Perhaps the largest popular front group dominated by communism, ladies and gentlemen, is the League for Peace and Democracy. It boasts of more than 4 million members. It parades under a most plausible name. It has for spokesmen, oftentimes, gentlemen of the cloth from practically every denomination. And it has lured into its membership many honest and sincere persons. Of the League for Peace and Democracy, Dr. Matthew says, quoting, "The American League Against War and Fascism is the most ambitious and influential of all the communist united fronts launched in this country. The name of the organization, I hardly need to remind this committee, was changed last winter to the American League for Peace and Democracy. For brevity's sake, I shall hereafter speak of this united front as the American League. The American League for Peace and Democracy now claims 4 million adherents in this country. The extent of its influence is perhaps better measured by the fact that it has recently obtained the endorsement for its parade on August 6th of this year of the Solicitor General of the United States than by its claim of 4 million adherents. It also numbers among its supporters, in one way or another, high personages whose names I prefer not to mention. In September 1933, continues the doctor, a dingy old hall known as St. Nicholas Arena in New York City housed the United States Congress Against War. I presided over that meeting. This Congress Against War was planned by an arrangements committee of which I was the chairman. The sessions of this arrangements committee were held twice a week throughout the summer of 1933. The United States Congress Against War set up the American League for Peace and Democracy and selected me as its first national chairman. The nations of the world were bristling with new armaments. The threat of a new world war was increasing every year. Japan had seized Manchuria. Hitler had come to power in Germany. And Mussolini was rattling the saber with increased vigor. Our new organization, the American League, was set up for the purpose, or so it appeared on the surface, of enlisting millions of Americans to stop the drift to war and fascism. Our ostensible aim was to mobilize the peace sentiments of Americans into a powerful single force of public opinion. This, at least, was our story for publication. We set out to obtain the support of peace organizations, churches, trades and labor unions, and fraternal bodies. Every group, in fact, in which we could find any sentiment against war and fascism was the object of our solicitation. So we interviewed clergymen, college professors, professional leaders, and labor unionists, asking them to speak for us or to lend us their names as members of local committees. All of these things were on the surface. But now for the inside facts about the American League for Peace and Democracy. The decision, continues Dr. Matthews, the decision to set up the American League was actually made in Moscow. It all started with the triumph of Hitler in Germany. Hitler's rule spelled the disastrous defeat of the communist movement in Germany. It also marked the complete failure of the foreign policy of the Communist International in other countries of the world. The substance of that Soviet policy was the beating of social democrats, socialists, liberals, and the so-called reformists among trade unions. Moscow declared that these, rather than the fascists, were the chief enemies of communism. They were dubbed social fascists and were everywhere attacked and slandered. The result of that policy had left the communists a weak and isolated sect. In Germany, the Communist Party faced annihilation. In France, the United States, and Great Britain, it had no substantial influence. Moscow foresaw a military showdown with Hitler. It was to be a death struggle between the fascist dictator and the communist dictator. Stalin began to feel the need for powerful allies in that coming conflict. How should he get these allies among the unfriendly capitalist powers? Dr. Matthews continues by saying he summoned the communist leaders of the world to Moscow. They deliberated, and out of their deliberations came the decision to set up the Popular Front in France. But France was farther developed along the road to the final class struggle than was the United States. Sooner or later, the communists must set up a popular front in the United States. But first they decided to set up the American League, a prelude to an American popular front. Well, Earl Browder brought back the word from Moscow, and I was chosen by Browder and his colleagues in the Communist Party to head the new organization. I was what the communists call a fellow traveler, one who closely sympathizes with most of the aims of the party, but who is nevertheless just a middle-class intellectual. The actual management of the affairs of the American League, continues the doctor, were turned over to Donald Henderson. Henderson had publicly declared his membership in the Communist Party a year or two before, when he resigned from the Socialist Party, and while he was still an instructor in economics at Columbia University. Henderson was later assigned by the Communist Party to agitational work among farmers. He is now the head of the CIO Union for Farmers. He has lately been active among the pecan workers of Texas. He is now the head of the United Cannery, Agricultural, Packing, and Allied Workers of America, which is affiliated with the CIO. Those are Dr. Matthews' words. The doctor continues. The Communist International selected Henri Barbusse as its international midwife at the birth of the American League. The Daily Worker, the Communist Party newspaper, stated recently that Barbusse was the founder of the American League. Barbusse died in the Kremlin in Moscow shortly after his tour of the United States on behalf of the newly formed American League. The Constitution of the Communist International states explicitly that leading comrades may go from country to country only with the consent of the Executive Committee of the Communist International. In December 1933, continues the doctor, Earl Browder, General Secretary of the American Communist Party, went to Moscow to report the results of the decision to set up the American League for Peace and Democracy. We led, said Browder in his report, we led a highly successful United States Congress against war. The Congress from the beginning was led by our party quite openly. These facts should dispose once and for all of the question of whether or not the American League was launched by the Communist Party. Nevertheless, there are numerous participants in this Communist United Front who are still fooled into thinking that it is an independent agency for peace and democracy. The Communist Party plans it that way. And fellow travelers like myself have tried to make it appear that way. It was easy to get party members and fellow travelers in order to start the American League. They were to be hard for the asking. It required long and patient work to get the stooges. The first half dozen such decoys were the hardest to get. After that, the decoys decoyed each other. There was great jubilation in the headquarters of the American League on the occasion when we were able to list as a speaker one of the nationally prominent officers of the General Federation of Women's Clubs. Every additional stooge or decoy made it twice as easy to get another. We had, continues the doctor, we had an almost perfect trick for silencing any critic who suspected or knew the communist nature of our United Front. All we had to do was to cry red baiting. The cry of red baiting is the best trick ever invented, short of a firing squad, for making short work of anybody who dares to object to communist theories or practices. If he isn't effectively silenced, he is at least thoroughly discredited in that vast flock of citizens who like to think of themselves as liberals. A 20th century American liberal would rather face the charge of slapping his grandmother than to be accused of red baiting. And so the cry of red baiting enabled us, so speaks the doctor, to carry on the work of Moscow in this country with little or no molestation from knowing critics. Unquote. Ladies and gentlemen, the factual, uncontradictable testimony of Dr. Matthews, who was one of the chief factors in forming and operating the League for Peace and Democracy, that testimony cannot be set aside lightly. He should know of what he speaks. The American League for Peace and Democracy is very active today. Desperately active to save its existence. Hundreds of informed clergymen have deserted it. Thousands of awakened citizens have abandoned it. Oh, it's pitiful, but just to read how its present radical officers plead in vain to American Christians for money to carry on their Bolshevik propaganda. But let us continue with Dr. Matthews' expose of the League for Peace and Democracy. In referring to the efforts on the part of the League for Peace and Democracy to subvert the American Federation of Labor, the doctor says, quoting, "In most cases, the AFL trade unions were more difficult to enroll in the new United Front. In those days, 5 years ago, the communists were guilty of dual unionism. They had set up their own red unions under an international body with headquarters in Moscow. Among these red unions, which were participating in the newly formed American League, were the National Textile Workers Union, the National Mine Workers Union, the Marine Workers Industrial Union, the Needle Trade Workers Industrial Union. True, they were largely paper unions without any significant membership, but as long as they existed, they were guilty of dual unionism. Their presence in our United Front was all the proof that the AFL unions generally needed to establish the communist control of the American League for Peace and Democracy. There were, however, a few aides. He reminded me that my work was to enroll the members of middle-class organizations and that the Communist Party would take care of the trade union. He assured me that the communists already had several strategic men in important plants and industries where they would be in a position to sabotage vital processes in the event of war, just in case the United States should become involved in a war against the Soviet Union. In this connection, Henderson was especially boastful of a revolutionary nucleus in submarine plants in Connecticut, and of the work of Harry Bridges in the shipping industry on the West Coast. They were, Henderson claimed, secretly allied with the American League for Peace and Democracy. As everyone knows, the efforts of the Bolshevik borers from within failed to seduce the leaders of the American Federation of Labor. Unquote Dr. Matthews, by the way. This labor organization positively excludes communists from its ranks and is, in this respect, very contrary to the CIO, which admits communists and cooperates with them. But to proceed with Dr. Matthews' testimony, quotation. How, asked he, was the American League financed? The procedure was fourfold. First, there was the nickel diamond quarter drive upon the innocent. Next came the money-raising banquet for the upper middle class with Henri Barbusse, John Strachey, or Lord Marley as speaker. When these were insufficient, money was borrowed on notes signed by Corliss Lamont. I might intervene and say that this Corliss Lamont is a son of one of the great international bankers of New York City. He continued. And finally, in a pinch, we got Browder on the telephone and had him send over cash from the party chest, which was regularly stocked from Moscow. When one of our publicity stories included the name of Corliss Lamont, there was a rule that his family connections with the House of Morgan should be given appropriate emphasis. Marley's lordship was equally useful to our cause. Recently, continues the doctor, recently the American League held a parade in New York. Harry Elmer Barnes, newspaper columnist, was among the parade's marshals who were invited to make speeches for the occasion. Apparently, Mr. Barnes went too far in his pacifism and suggested that the United States should stay out of war, even a war in defense of the Soviet Union. When the officials of the American League saw an advance copy of his speech, Mr. Barnes was promptly notified that he would not be allowed to act as a marshal in the parade or to make a speech. The most pathetic thing about this incident was Barnes' statement to the press that he had not known that the Holy War Boys had got hold of the American League for Peace and Democracy. There's hardly any excuse for any moderately informed adult in the United States who says that he thought the American League was a peace organization. I was succeeded in the national chairmanship by Professor Harry F. Ward of Union Theological Seminary, who is still head of the league. Professor Ward is also national chairman of the American Civil Liberties Union and the head of the Methodist Federation for Social Service. Unquote. This concludes my reading from Dr. Matthews' official sworn testimony, which he gave before the Dyes Committee. A gentleman, a scholar, who helped to originate the American League for Peace and Democracy. In conclusion, my friends, may I extend my remarks on the popular front to quote Dr. R.J.C. Dorsey, whose memorable address now incorporated in the congressional record of August 3rd, 1939, deals with the subversion of youth in America. He says, in part, concerning the recent World Youth Congress. Quotation. Among the delegates at the World Youth Congress at Versailles were those from the Young Communist League. The All-Russian Young Communist League was organized in October 1918 after the workers' revolution in Russia of November 1917. Soon thereafter, other communist youth groups developed in various parts of Europe. And out of this movement grew the International Youth Conference in Vienna of August 6, 1919, and from which came the International Communist Youth Organization for young communists between 16 and 22 years of age. This conference led to the meeting of the International Youth Congress in Berlin, November 26, 1919, attended by 19 delegates from 14 countries, allegedly representing a membership of 229,000. It accepted the program of the Third Communist International, its affiliate, which had been set up in 1919. It advocated the overthrow of capitalism, government control by the workers, dictatorship by the proletariat, establishment of preparatory schools to teach communism, creation of drill and defense squads, and otherwise training students and youth for the class struggle. Factories are to become communist fortresses. In all unions, youth sections are to be formed. Obedience to and defense of the Soviet Union was pledged. Slogans were black and white, unite and fight. Do not abandon your friends, even though they still go to church on Sunday. Zinoviev observed, the youth movement is the best section of the Communist International. One may secure an idea from this of the nature of the young Communist League and the political ideas of its delegates at Vassar College. Other strictly youth groups sending delegates to the World Youth Congress at Vassar were the Student Peace Service, the Student Peace Committee, the Christian Youth Conference of North America, Youth Section of American Jewish Congress, the National Council of Methodist Youth, the National Council of Jewish Juniors, the Romanian Junior League Club, the Junior Hadassah, the National Student Federation of America. In order to preserve an appearance of respectability, the communists often include groups in their congresses that, strictly speaking, are not entirely of their faith. However, the communist group controls every situation. The American League for Peace and Democracy, continues Dr. Dorsey, has a youth section national committee. This parent organization was once known as the United States Congress Against War and Fascism, and for a time as the American League Against War and Fascism. Being a section of the World Committee Against War and Fascism, but now the World Committee for Peace and Democracy. Well, the United States branch is one of 33 nationals that the radicals have organized in 35 different countries. Communists here occupy the strategic position and here control the policies in reference to the League among its 4 million members. Lenin wrote, "Frequent change of name bewilders the public. For example, in 1921, the Friends Disarmament Council was formed, subsequently merged into the National Council for Limitation of Armament, which in turn became the National Student Forum, which is conducted by the National Council for Prevention of War. This is a characteristic of radical groups," unquote Lenny, who lets the cat out of the bag. Whether or not the above statements prove interesting to a radio audience is immaterial. Ladies and gentlemen, the fact is that you must become conscious of the activity, which, like wolves in sheep's clothing, consistently are destroying the foundations of our Americanism and Christianity. At one time under the guise of patriotism, modern Benedict Arnolds who wear the uniform of citizenship bore from within the army of our population to betray it. At another time, Judas Iscariot, who used the insignia of Christianity and religion, beat a pathway to the stronghold where sit the descendants of Annas and Caiaphas to resell Christ's brothers for 30 pieces of silver. At no time in the history of the world, and at no time in the history of this country, will we be free from the Arnolds and the Iscariots. At no time can we disregard the counsel that eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. Nevertheless, my friend, the modern pattern is plain. It is a pattern of destruction, a pattern by following which decay was produced in the nations of yesterday, a pattern which the subversive forces of Antichrist utilizes to lure the innocent people of all nations into the graveyard of national death. My friends, I call upon you to arouse yourselves to oppose the betrayals of your heritage. And I ask, if the enemies of our Americanism and Christianity have been successful in building up a following of millions of propagandized supporters, is it not right and just for us to organize a counterforce to forefend their attacks? Call this counterforce by any name you please. But organize yourselves under competent leaders who are well informed and well disciplined in their lives. Organize yourselves under leaders capable of challenging the popular front, the Antichrist, anti-American front, wherever it manifests itself. There are at least 60 well-established committees and organizations and societies and leagues incorporated in the so-called popular front in these United States. These 60 subversive pink or red or brown anti-Christian and anti-American cults challenge you. And what do I say? Only this. March them committee for committee, society for society, league for league. Match them in your communities, your schools, your colleges, and your churches. But match them and beat them, not with the whip of physical force, but with the sword of justice and peace. And what does all this mean? Certainly, this means a division. Certainly, This calls for a separation of the sheep from the goats. Certainly, this demands suffering and sacrifice on your part. Or you will be assailed. You will be attacked. You will be scarred with labels today and with physical prosecution tomorrow. And some of you, before this contest comes to an end, will have won the companionship of the millions whom Lenin and Trotsky and Bella Kuhn martyred. Yes, some of you clergymen listening to me may even win the crown of martyrdom which was placed upon the brow of Michael Pro of Mexico, the same crown gained by the martyred priests of Spain. Oh, my friend, there must be no surrender. There must be no immoral apathy. None of us can afford in this contest to adopt the policy which is identified with the prudence of the flesh. Oh, yes, we speak of the rights of man, but more importantly today, let us begin to speak of the rights of God. For there can be no lasting human rights, no liberty, no life, no pursuit of happiness, unless God's rights are defended unto death. And we speak of peace. Certainly every person desires peace. But be it clearly understood, there can be no peace without justice. The justice which gives not only to every man his due, but the justice by which we creatures give to God his due. From a practical viewpoint, therefore, and when confronted by the popular front, which either knowingly or unknowingly condemns God and joins with the Bolsheviks in crying that religion is the opium of the people, from a practical viewpoint, I beg you, do not be reluctant to identify yourselves with some Christian organization. But I warn you to beware of organizations which pretend to be Christian and which in reality are nothing more than arms of the popular front. Organizations which boast of the name of Christian and yet are officered and organized by individuals whose lives and policies and proposals belie that boast. Thus I take advantage of this occasion to tell you how both the Reverend Dr. Edward Lodge Curran, my colleague, and I both discouraged an organization known as the Christian Mobilizers, not only from using our names, but from pursuing their determination to hold a mass gathering in Union Square, New York City. We stand for peace, not bloodshed. We uphold race tolerance, not race prejudice. We advocate the preservation of American rights and not the institution of Bolshevik dictatorship. And we gladly share the opinion that this contest between Christ and chaos, between Americanism and internationalism, between justice and injustice, cannot be settled by a mere show of misdirected force, a force whose fourth and last court of appeal, according to certain leaders, is the blackjack, the stink bomb, and perhaps the machine gun. But speaking for myself, I maintain that no organization can qualify as Christian unless its members first make Christians of themselves. For without the leaven of Christian leadership, in individual membership, no group can stand. No group can succeed. And remember that in the concept of Christianity, that there is room for every national, for every racial element in this world, both Jew and Gentile. But do not misinterpret me. God's rights demand that if we are Christians, we will not suffer without contest to have anti-Christians attempt to liquidate the principles which are God's. And if we are Americans, we will not permit, without a struggle, the subversive elements within our country to undermine the tenets of Americanism. My friends, here we are. We content ourselves with investigating and studying the Bolshevik movements in America, movements which constitute the Popular Front, and we're preparing to become first-class historians or readers of history. But I ask you, what are we doing about it? Of all Christ said, be a doers of the word and not hearers only. What are we Americans doing to attract the millions of decent persons in this country who have succumbed to the Popular Front? What are we doing to attract them to the Christian American method of thinking? With that question, may I now ask the announcer to introduce another voice. And as for myself, I say God bless you. God keep you. God keep all of us.
Ladies and gentlemen, be sure to write this week to Father Coughlin to encourage him. And please ask him to mail you a copy of the factual address to which you have just listened. As you know, every weekday, Monday through Friday, the voice of social justice is heard on the air in the Michigan and Illinois-Indiana areas. On August the 28th, this weekly comment on the news will be initiated for Ohio. WCKY, the 50,000-watt station at Covington, Kentucky, 1 minute from Cincinnati, will join this new network. Within a short time, the Colonial Network covering New England and the Philadelphia station will likewise be added to this weekday service. How many New Englanders and citizens of Philadelphia want this? Well, here is a sample of the voice of social justice.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, you have all probably heard that America is the land of free speech, but evidently this statement doesn't apply to New York. In the last few years, the largest city in the United States has resembled more a city in dictatorial Germany, Italy, or Russia than an American community. There is free speech in New York, oh yes, but only for communist and leftist mob leaders. Let an American get up on the street corner and say a word for Christianity and Americanism, and he will be fortunate to escape with his life. A short time ago, Mr. Floyd Caridi of New York and a few patriotic Christians attempted to distribute some pamphlets at a New York City street corner. But attempt was all they could do. Before they had time to pass out more than a few pamphlets, a horde of communists appeared from nowhere, rushed Mr. Caridi and his friends, tore up their literature, and forced them to seek refuge in a nearby store. But let Mr. Caridi describe the event in his own words, which I take from a letter published in the Brooklyn Tablet. Water and garbage were hurled out of windows. A car was driven through the crowd of assembled Christians. Vile language was heaped upon both Protestant and Catholic clergymen and laymen. Mounted policemen had to be called to repel the anti-Christian rioters. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, this is what is taking place in the streets of New York almost every day in the year. These are the tactics employed by the Red Popular Front in the city where, according to Mayor Fiorella LaGuardia, 7 million people live in peace and enjoy the benefits of democracy. If these riots had occurred in the streets of Danzig, Berlin, Rome, or London, they would have been headlined in newspapers throughout the world. But since they happened in New York, they are cloaked with silence. And why? Is it that these street fights, which remind me of the beginning of the persecutions of Christians in the time of Trotsky and Bela Kun, is it that these street fights are embarrassing to the leftist moguls who control the destinies of America's largest city? Is it that radical newspaper writers are shocked to find that there are people who dare to question communist control of the streets? Is it that these writers are so shocked that they can find no words to describe their grief and dismay? Whatever the answer to this may be, I must declare that this practiced silence on the part of the New York press in failing to report assaults on Christians is only breeding repercussions. And according to the Brooklyn Tablet news reports today, Bolshevik meetings were held within a few blocks without any interruption or disorder caused by those espousing the cause of Christianity and Americanism. Well, ladies and gentlemen, today in New York, and tomorrow in your city and my city. So you see that Father Coughlin's advice to join an organization for the protection of Christianity and Americanism is more than timely.
Ladies and gentlemen, next Sunday afternoon,